You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso and espresso and cream flavors. I had one this morning before I came into the studio, and let me tell you, it gave me just the boost I needed to get my day going. Plus, it tastes so delicious, I'd drink it anyway. So close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. My guest today is a renowned particle physicist and the United Kingdom's leading science communicator who's been hailed as the natural successor to Sir David Attenborough. Professor Brian Cox has hosted numerous scientific television shows and sold over 1 million books worldwide, and his live touring shows have all the excitement and high-tech effects of a rock concert and sell out entire stadiums like London's Wembley Arena. It's not surprising, because as Brian Cox reveals on today's podcast, he started out in a popular rock band long before he went into science. He shares why he left the world of rock and roll for particle physics, what he's learning through his participation in the ATLAS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider, and why he says the HCL has disproven the existence of ghosts. He discusses Brexit, the vital link between democracy and science, and his concerns over a growing education disparity. He talks about walking in the footsteps of his hero, Carl Sagan, as a leading science communicator, the idea that he has the hardest time explaining to non-scientists, and how the digital effects wizards behind the movie Interstellar are helping him elucidate the wonders of the universe in his spectacular new live show, Universal: Adventures in Space and Time. Plus, why he's ready to call a truce in his ongoing feud with Deepak Chopra. Coming up with Professor Brian Cox in just a moment. Brian Cox is an English physicist who serves as professor of particle physics in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Manchester, the Royal Society Professor for Public Engagement in Science, and a fellow at the Royal Society. As an award-winning science communicator, his books on science have sold over 1 million copies worldwide, and his acclaimed television programs like Wonders of the Solar System have earned him 2 Royal Television Society Awards and a Peabody Award. He's also the host of the popular BBC radio program, The Infinite Monkey Cage, and holds a Guinness record for the largest live science tour. He's now embarking on another world tour with a brand new live event called Universal: Adventures in Space and Time. Professor Brian Cox, welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, I addressed you as Professor Brian Cox, but I also know that you are an officer of the Order of the British Empire, so do you prefer Sir Brian Cox or Professor Brian Cox?
That's not sir. I haven't been elevated to that level yet. It's somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
I prefer Brian.
Okay. So you don't get that. You don't get to be addressed as sir?
No, it's
what's the difference?
The British honours system is complicated and labyrinthine. So basically, I think that's about halfway up. You can have an MBE and then an OBE and then a CBE and then a KBE. And the KBE is the knight, a knight of the British Empire, or the Order of the British Empire. And then you get the sir.
So you didn't do the whole thing with the sword and all that?
No, it was given to me by the Queen, which my mum and dad were absolutely delighted about.
What is that like? Does she still wield the sword at her age?
Yes, she does. She has that, and you go to Buckingham Palace, and you and she chats to you for a short while, and then gives you your medal.
That's a big honor. Do they feed you at those things? What's the spread like?
No, they don't actually. No, you go in and do that, and then you. Because quite a few people come through, so they would have to have a banquet, which they don't do.
Well, I read that when you were 12, Carl Sagan's book Cosmos inspired you to become a physicist, and in many ways, you're actually following in his footsteps. Now, when you were first contemplating a career in science, did you want to go into research, or did you always envision yourself becoming a science communicator like Sagan?
No, it was... always research for me. I wanted to be an astronomer from I don't know what age, 4 or 5 years old. You know, it's just one of those things that captured my imagination. And then when I was 12, as you say, Cosmos came on television. And, you know, at that time, certainly in the UK, you only had 3 television channels. There was very little science on television. And then to get 13 weeks of Cosmos, which I still think is one of, if not the greatest science documentary ever made, was sort of confirmed to me that I was interested in the stars and galaxies and cosmology, interested in the questions of how did the universe begin, how old is it, where did we come from, those questions. But the most important thing for me, which I've always carried with me about Sagan, is that he put the science into context. He turned it into a polemic. I mean, the very famous 13th episode of Cosmos is really about nuclear war, which was central in our, I don't know, in our experience at the time. You're talking about 1979, 1980, the height of the Cold War. And so he didn't just say, we have discovered that there are, in modern terms, 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. But he would say what that perspective means and how it might inform the way that we behave on Earth. So he's very clear that science is not a isolated discipline in itself. It is part of culture. It is part of the foundations of our civilization. And very importantly, the way that you think as a scientist is applicable to other fields. It should not be separated. Science should not be separated from politics or art or literature. It is part of the human condition. It's part of the way we explore what it means to be human.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we do tend to separate science from other disciplines and other areas of our lives. But when I look back to the most oppressive regimes in history, I don't think it's a coincidence that Nazi Germany was built on a whole ideology of pseudoscience, or that the Soviet Union experimented with telekinesis and was trying to build some super army of guerrilla human hybrids under Stalin, or even more recently that you have certain African dictators who didn't believe AIDS exists. Is part of the case for science also the case for democracy and good government?
It's a very good question. That Richard Feynman, who's a great hero of mine, who works here at Caltech, not far from where we are now, wrote a beautiful essay. I think it was part of a speech, actually, that he gave, which turned to an essay called The Value of Science. So he talks about what are the, beyond the science itself, what is the value of this pursuit? And obviously did all the old things you can say. It's the foundation of civilization, technology. Sure. But ultimately, he said he called it a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance. That's his definition of science. And he said that the thing is, science is about celebrating the unknown, of course. Mm-hmm. Research science is about standing on the edge of the known and peering into the unknown and celebrating the fact that we don't know. And he said, your question was right. He said, that's actually the foundation of democracy, if you think about it. Well, democracy rests on the idea that we don't know how to run a society. It is very complicated. And so what we do is we use a trial and error system. We throw people out every 4 years or whatever it is, get new people in, because absolutism has no place. It has no place in science. It has no place in the running of a society either. And so that parallel, I think, is very important. It's a, science is often presented, I think, as a sometimes misrepresented as a people's telling other people how it is. Mm-hmm. So we say the universe is 13.8 billion years old, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and this is it. The passing knowledge down from the mountain on stone tablets. When in fact, it's the opposite of that. That science is, as Feynman said, a celebration of our ignorance. It is the recognition that we don't know and may not ever know everything about the universe. But it requires humility to do it, to be a scientist.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's most disturbing to me about the political climate these days is I hear so many people saying, I think, or I believe. I don't hear as many people as I used to saying, I don't know.
Yes.
You, as a scientist, probably say, I don't know how many times a day.
Oh, when as a research scientist, anyone who's listening who's done any research, master's or a PhD, will know that most of the time you're wrong. Mm-hmm. Because you're very nature is a beautiful but difficult thing to study. One of the key things studying nature tells you is that there is a right and wrong in the sense that you can be wrong. So nature doesn't care who you are or how important you are, how much work you've done, how much energy you've put into your idea. If it disagrees with nature, again, as Richard Feynman famously said, if it disagrees with nature, it is wrong. So that's important. But actually, there's another great piece of work by Robert Oppenheimer. So most people have heard of Oppenheimer from the Manhattan Project, from the atom bomb. But he was a great theoretical physicist. He did a lot of early work on black holes, for example, general relativity. But in the 1950s, after he'd had a difficult time, obviously personally, feeling partly responsible for the atom bomb, which, and we could debate that for a long time, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, whether it kept the peace.
Yeah, I am Death, the destroyer of worlds, or what was it?
I am become Death, the destroyer of worlds, said Oppenheimer, quoting Hindu scripture, I think.
Right.
So he was tortured by that. But also he had, I think, quite a few interactions with McCarthy and those people. He had a difficult political life. But he gave the BBC Reith Lectures in 1953. Mm-hmm. So they're very famous. Bertrand Russell had done the one the year before. So, and Oppenheimer, I think everyone thought he was going to speak about the atom bomb, his greatest hits, you know. But he didn't. He talked about, it was called Science and the Common Understanding.
Huh.
And he made a very similar point to Feynman, which is that science teaches you things, that the study of nature forces you to think in certain ways which are useful to in general, in politics or whatever, many different fields. And one of them is that you have to hold different ideas in your head simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And the example he gave, because this is in the 1950s, in the early days of quantum mechanics, really, he talked about the fact that nature forces you to think about a particle, like an electron, sometimes as a point-like object, like a little billiard ball that bounces around, and sometimes as an extended object that has wave-like properties. So we're sat in a small room now making this podcast, and one of the descriptions, the description of an electron, if you put that little particle in the middle of this room, it fills the room in some sense. So it's not a thing that you can localize in one place.
Yeah.
So you've got to hold both the point-like localized version in your head and the extended wave-like version in your head at the same time to get a complete picture of nature. And he drew the parallel with that in politics. He said, for example, you could be on the left of politics, and he uses the word communist because I said communism was in his mind at the time, I think, with McCarthy and all that stuff. So he said, so communism, that might be a understanding that the collective, the group, has needs, and we have to operate as a collective group of people.
Interesting.
But then the more right wing view, you might call libertarian or whatever, conservative, would be the rights of the individual are paramount.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, he makes the point that you have to hold both in your head if you're going to run a society properly. There are needs of the many, and there are needs of the one. And it's a beautiful, I recommend it. It's on the BBC's website. You can download the PDFs. You can listen to one of them. They actually, can you believe it? They erased over some of them. They don't exist anymore.
Oh, gosh.
But the text exists. But they're very dense and very deep. He was a very deep thinker. But that key point that I think is the fact that nature, the study of nature, forces you to think. It forces you to be humble, and it forces you to think in ways that are useful.
Mm-hmm. a moment ago, you said that the perception can be that scientists are just kind of doling out information from on high. And I wonder, you know, because recently there's been this backlash for some reason against experts and expertise. And I wonder if that's part of the problem, if maybe part of the responsibility for that lies on the experts themselves and how they're presenting themselves.
I think it is more an indictment of our education system, actually, because as I've said, that I think people react when they are shown to be wrong. So you can be wrong. And as we've just discussed, you most often are in science. You're very rarely right.
Right.
We can argue, actually.
And scientists, they take as much satisfaction in being wrong, it seems, as they do in being right.
Because
it's still the thrill of discovery.
Because you've learned more about the universe. If you have a theory and the theory turns out to be incorrect, you've learned something about the universe. So I think the problem is that science does have measurements. For example, the age of the Earth would be a good one, right? We know that the Earth is around 4.5 billion years old. It's actually quite precisely, and I'll get the number wrong because the details change as we learn new things. It's something like 5.54 billion years old, I think, with some error on it.
Yeah. And it changes every day, I guess.
It does. There are people narrowing down those errors. Yeah. Now, that's a measurement.
Yeah.
So if you think that the Earth is 6,000 years old, you're not right. You're just wrong, full stop, because of this, and this. So now people, I think it is a skill that you have to learn to celebrate being shown to be wrong because you've learned more.
Mm-hmm.
So some people would rather be shown to be right, be seen to be right, rather than learn more by being wrong. And that's a skill that I think needs to be taught at school.
Yeah.
So it's not about being right. I mean, I would argue, actually, it's possible that none of our theories of physics at the moment, I think it's probable, none of them are right. They're approximations, they're models. Einstein's general theory of relativity is not the final word on gravity.
Right.
Quantum theory, as we have it at the moment, is not going to be the final word. Some bits of it might be. Some bits of those theories might be the final word. But we're learning. We're evolving and our knowledge is getting more precise. And that's such an important skill to celebrate being shown to be wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. So it's not the scientists can't help it. Right. Just as I often draw an analogy with, this idea that everyone has an opinion that should be listened to, et cetera.
Yeah.
Think about an aircraft designer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you rarely get people on the plane saying, well, I disagree with the shape of those wings. I think they should be cubic, or something like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. So I think people do understand innately that expertise is important. When their plumbing fails or something, or their electrics fail, you bring an expert in to fix it. So people know that. But I think it's these deeply held positions that people take can be shown to be wrong.
Yeah.
So the age of the Earth is a good example.
Yeah, it is strange. Why is it that so many people, they trust science when it comes to knowing that their computer's going to turn on when they press the power button, or knowing that botulism is bad for you, but when it comes to certain things like climate change or like vaccinations, they suddenly get greeted with all this skepticism?
Yeah, because we're seeing a culture war. We're seeing people with entrenched positions. And these things are a proxy for something deeper.
Mm.
The important thing that politicians should be doing is trying to unravel what the deeper point is. So why are people taking these totemic issues, which have nothing to do with anything, right? They're a symptom of something else. It is not rational to argue against vaccination as a public health measure. It is not, but that's not what these people are doing, actually, I think. It's not that that's a symptom of something deeper. And the deeper thing is a problem. So I'm not trying to criticize people who take strange positions, because what I'm saying is I think that those strange positions are a proxy for something else.
Mm-hmm.
And the something else is probably important. It's probably that, you know, that the society is not working well for them. They're as I said, there have been failures in the education system and so on. So those things are real issues. And I think the trick in politics is to dig down below the nonsense and find out what the real substance is.
Well, I know that you've been pretty outspoken on Brexit, and I actually just over the weekend watched this great HBO movie with Benedict Cumberbatch called Brexit. I don't know if you've seen it yet. It was so good.
I started watching it, and I watched about 10 minutes, and I got so angry because it's not been played out yet.
Yeah,
the story's still yet to be reminded. So I don't. When I know what's happened, then I'll probably watch it.
Yeah, I mean, it is nerve-wracking, and it must be frustrating for people who are on the stay side like yourself, because you had so many people on the leave side who jumped to that position, and it seems without really knowing all the facts and without knowing the consequences of it, and they're only starting to realize those consequences after it's too late, now that they've already voted to leave.
It's what I had in mind when I made my comments earlier about the fact that these positions people take up are often really just a symptom of something deeper. Mm-hmm. And there are big problems in the UK, as there are, I think, in the US, with the way our society works, with inequality in society, with the lack of opportunity of certain mm-hmm. groups, lack of investment in certain areas of the country. You know, here you have the Rust Belt and so on. It's the same in Britain. And so those problems are real. And that's why I think we have to be careful not to criticise voters who vote mm-hmm. for things that we find absurd mm-hmm. or you know, almost self-evidently destructive. But the point is that there is something deeper there.
Yeah.
And this is the challenge with something like Brexit, is to say, well, this is a destructive course. It's clearly a destructive course of action. However, that there are real things to be addressed in the deal that we do in our mm-hmm. society. That the deal has to be rethought. And I think that's the key message. So something good might come out of the turbulence, both here and in the UK, in that sense, that actually at least now we are aware that there are groups of people who've done extremely badly out of our societies. And that's the thing we need to treat.
In the media, we hear so much discussion of income equality, but I think what is an even more important fundamental underlying problem is education inequality.
Yeah. Yes, I think equality of opportunity is what we should be focused on. But that's my personal view.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it is true, and people have been listening to this going, yes, but, you know, what is it? Was it 40 people own sort of a third of the wealth in the world or something? I can't remember.
Right.
I mean, these extremes, I think, are not helpful, right?
Right.
But ultimately, as you say, I really profoundly agree that really what I care about is that my kids have the opportunity to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that there is not equality of opportunity across America or actually the UK as well.
Yeah.
And so that's what we need to address first. I actually think that income inequality sort of gets addressed, partly at least, if you make sure that every kid has the same chance.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Professor Brian Cox when we come back in just a minute. Hey folks, Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and if you're like me, you know how hard it can be to come up with a great Valentine's gift that's personal and actually shows you put thought into it. If you want something that's a reminder of the special memories in your relationship, check out Homesick Candles. Homesick Candles' unique scents reflect all the U.S. states and dozens of cities around the world. They're a thoughtful way to tell the story of your relationship's journey. Each candle is made from a natural soy wax blend and comes in a beautiful gift box. Their new First Kiss candle even lets you celebrate the spot where you shared your first kiss. Just go to homesick.com and check out their First Kiss Finder to pick yours. I'll never forget, my wife and I shared our first kiss on an October night in Pasadena, California. And every time I light Homesick's Southern California candle, that distinctive smell of orange blossoms and jasmine in the night air brings all those memories flooding back. Another place I've spent a lot of time over the years is Austin, Texas. Every time I light Homesick's Austin candle, the pine scent reminds me of swimming in Barton Creek. The hints of cedar wood take me all the way back to my boyhood at summer camp in the Texas Hill Country. And the notes of musk and leather even remind me of the night my wife and our friends went bar hopping along Austin's famous 6th Street. That's because none of our other senses have the power to evoke a special memory, a sense of time and place like scent does. Maybe even a moment from long ago that you might have thought you'd forgotten. That's what makes Homesick Candles such a brilliant idea. I'm already thinking about which candles to get for my friends' birthdays, for my brother, and my parents' anniversary, because a gift that actually has meaning to someone is priceless.
So go to homesick.com, and for every classic size or three-wick candle you purchase, you'll get a free mini candle of your choice. Just pick your favorite memories and candle, add them to your cart, and for each classic or three-wick, you can add your choice of any mini candle for free. All you have to do is enter the code KICK at checkout. That's homesick.com with promo code KICK for this awesome deal. One more time, homesick.com and promo code KICK. This great offer is only available until February 15th, so order now. In today's age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and learn more, especially when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming. So you might think that you don't have time to read a book or develop yourself. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways and need-to-know information, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library, from self-help, business, and health to history books. I read a lot of books for interviews on this podcast, and that takes up a large part of my day. But with Blinkist, I can get to the most important points of a book, which prepares me for my interviews in less time, and really makes me a more intelligent, informed, healthy me. For instance, I just had Dr. Steven Pinker back on the podcast, so beforehand I used Blinkist for a quick refresher course on two of his most recent books, The Better Angels of Our Nature and Enlightenment Now. They have a long list of books available. Over the holidays, I used Blinkist to reacquaint myself with Dale Carnegie's classic, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Plus, I'm an auditory learner, so being able to listen with Blinkist suits me perfectly. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for my audience. Go to Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. One more time, Blinkist.com/kick. Did you know that 43% of college graduates are underemployed, working jobs that don't even require a college degree? Imagine if one of the most significant investments of your life, your college degree, only worked half the time. A refund is the least you'd expect. With courses in software engineering, data science, and UX/UI design, Flatiron School stands behind its students with a tuition money-back guarantee. Flatiron offers graduates a career services program with career coaches and ongoing learning. Students who follow every step of the plan and don't get a qualifying tech job offer within 6 months of graduating are eligible for a full tuition refund. See the complete details at flatironschool.com/terms. With graduates at hundreds of leading tech companies, the Flatiron School program is working. Full and part-time programs are available online and at Flatiron School campuses around the world. Join the school that's reinventing education, starting with student outcomes. Learn more at flatironschool.com/kickass. Again, that's flatironschool.com/kickass. And now, back to the show. Now, I want to get back to your early career in science. Before you even went into science, you had a rock band, right? Weren't you, what was it? I don't even know how to say this. There's Dare, and then there's either Dream D-Ream was your band.
Yeah. So Dare, when I was, like most people, I suppose, when I was growing up as a teenager, I was into physics. I was always into physics and astronomy. But I got interested in music, really to be in a band. So I wasn't I didn't have lessons, for example. I wasn't one of those kids who goes to piano lessons.
You were self-taught.
Yeah, and I did it because I wanted to be a rock star, right? Now, you don't think you're going to be a rock star.
Well, but, you know, in fairness, I had Roger Daltrey on not that long ago, and he pretty much went the same path. He taught himself, he built his own guitar, and, you know, worked out for him. So it's not a crazy idea.
No, and that's what I did. And actually, talk about Roger building his guitar, I built electronic instruments because you couldn't get them in the sort of 80s.
Really?
They were very, very, the 70s, very expensive.
Yeah.
So we used to, in our physics lessons at school, myself and a friend of mine used to go to our physics teacher and say, we need to build a little thing to interface this drum machine to this thing and you know, this keyboard, and build a thing called a noise gate and all sorts of stuff that we used to do. But then we made a demo tape, my little school band, and a guy, the keyboard player from the band Thin Lizzy, you might know, moved close to where we live in near Manchester and in the north of England. And I gave him a demo tape and he must have listened to it. But then when Thin Lizzy split up, he formed a band and he just came to me and said, do you want to audition for the band? And I was 18. So I said, yeah. And I got into the band. So I said, I won't go to university for a year. I'll have a year off. Okay. And I will just be in this band. And then we got a record deal, not surprisingly, because the guy had been in Thin Lizzy anyway and knew everybody, I suppose, with A&M Records. And ended up here in LA recording an album with a great two producers, Mike Shipley and Larry Klein. And Larry Klein at the time was married to Joni Mitchell, and we recorded some of it in her house. And we had this amazing kind of life. And this is, you know, from I'd been out of the country once. When I was 18, I'd been on a school trip to Austria, I think, and that was it. And I found myself in LA recording an album with these gods of music.
Yeah, right? Wow.
And so that was the, and then we ended up touring, and so we had about 5 years of that. Actually,
yeah.
So I didn't go.
You were
to
the real deal. This wasn't just a pipe dream.
No, it just made two albums with A&M.
Wow.
Here in both in LA, actually.
What happened? Why'd you go into science?
Well, I'd always, as I said, from the age of 4 or 5, I wanted to be an astronomer. So I was reading science books on the tours, and I was a keyboard player, and all keyboard players are into science, and it was a geeky kind of thing to do. And then the band sort of had a bit of a fight, and we'd all got a bit sick of each other.
Of course, okay.
And I went back, and the day after, I applied to the University of Manchester to do physics.
Okay.
Got in, and I had a year to wait. It was kind of a bad time. It was October or something. I couldn't go till the following year.
Oh, yeah.
So I got a job as a sound engineer with this band, D-Ream, who didn't have a record deal. And then they got a record deal and said, do you want to play keyboards? And the most famous thing we did as a band was we had a big number one hit in the UK. But the song got used by Tony Blair to get elected in 1997. So there's a song called Things Can Only Get Better, which you could use now, actually, politically in both our countries.
Yeah, for sure.
And so that had a second life with this band, D-Ream.
Well, you chose particle physics. Mm-hmm. What interested you specifically in that area of science?
It's they're both cosmology and particle physics. They sort of meet at the... in certain areas, certainly close to the origin of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I became interested in. So I became interested in how, in the laws of nature and how they behave very close to the Big Bang.
Okay.
And that was that one way of looking at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, which is where I...
Which you're working
many
on,
years.
Right?
Yeah. One way of looking at that is that it recreates the conditions that were present less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang.
Wow.
So you'll... And what we've learned is that the physical laws are simpler back then. So it's one way of looking at the evolution of the universe.
That's interesting, really.
Yeah.
How does that work? Because aren't physical laws fixed and permanent?
Well, right. I mean, I'm being sort of lazy with my language.
It's
So for example, there's a force called the electromagnetic force, which is we're very familiar with refrigerator magnets and so on and electricity. And then there's a force called the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for, if you're a college student, you'll know radioactive beta decay. So it's certain kinds of radioactive decay. Also very important in the way that the sun shines and stars shine. So it's the force that allows you to build helium from hydrogen, which is what stars do. So it's an important force hidden from us in everyday life, really, apart from radioactive decay. But what we find is you go to higher and higher temperatures, higher and higher energies. Those forces are seen to be one and the same force. So they're one thing that sort of splits as the universe cools into two different phenomena. So what we find is that the description of nature in the very earliest times seems to be simpler. And then it's almost as if complexity emerges as a process of the universe cooling, but also actually going from a very ordered system at the Big Bang to a disordered system, which is going to be the future of the universe. So it's in that sense that I mean that the laws of nature. I mean, for example, we hope, we don't know, but what one of the things, maybe hope's the wrong word, but it would be nice if there was a grand unified theory of everything, a theory of everything.
Right.
That so that would be a simpler description of nature. And so that experimentally, that's what we see to some extent. So the Large Hadron Collider, as I said, is a very high energy physics laboratory, essentially, where you can look at the way that the laws of nature behave in these rather extreme conditions that we don't see in everyday life.
It's an exciting time to be in your profession, because up till now, you didn't really have the ability to test these theories. You could do computer simulations and come up with theories, but you've come along right at the perfect time when the technology is actually catching up to where you can actually prove or disprove these things.
Yes, I mean part of that separation between those two forces we talked about, the weak force and the electromagnetic force. Mm-hmm. Part of that is the Higgs mechanism that's involved in that separation.
Yeah.
And so the Higgs boson, this thing, was predicted in the 1960s by Peter Higgs and others. And it wasn't until the 21st century that we had the technology to build a particle collider big enough to see it. But we have seen it. We didn't have to see it. In fact, my most cited paper, my academic paper, is called, it's something like Physics at the Large Hadron Collider Without a Light Higgs, right? So in the abstract, it says that. It's called WW Scattering, actually. But in the abstract, it says, so this is a paper about what physics we might expect if there isn't a Higgs boson at the LHC. And it was very highly cited because it came up with it. We had some techniques in it that are used experimentally now. But the actual basis of it, it's important to say that the LHC was built either to find the Higgs boson or find the physics that does the job of the Higgs boson that we might not have thought of, because nature can sometimes be smarter than we are. But that's why that was a very exciting project. And it's ultimately why it got built, because this is the power of our theories. So we knew, going back to what we spoke about right at the start of this podcast, we knew that our theory broke down and would not describe nature at those energies, at the energies that the LHC can collide particles together, if there wasn't a Higgs boson. So we knew that we would either demonstrate this 40 or 50-year-old theory was correct, or find something else, find a different way that nature was behaving.
Wow. Now, I heard somewhere along the way that you said that the Large Hadron Collider disproves the existence of ghosts. Can you explain how that works?
No, it was kind of you mentioned our thing, the infinite monkey cage, and we have these bizarre discussions on that show. What I meant was, so let's analyze what a ghost is. So usually it is something that looks like the dead person. Right, so it carries some information about the person.
Okay.
So you might say, well, it's their soul or something like that. There's some kind of disembodied thing which must interact with our bodies. So it must interact with the matter in our bodies.
Okay.
In order for it to carry information about our bodies. Or indeed, if you're talking about a soul, then it must interact now, because I'm lifting my hand up and down now. So presumably, if I have some internal thing that guides that, some eternal bit of me that persists after I die, it is able to interact with the matter in my hand. Now, the point is that we know what that matter is, and we know how it behaves and how it interacts with extreme precision at these energies, at room temperature now, 20 degrees Celsius, whatever. We know 75 degrees Fahrenheit, right?
Okay.
We know.
Thank you for that.
how the physics works. And actually, that many physicists claim, I think this is right, we can claim to know that physics that happens at everyday temperatures and energies with extreme accuracy. We just know it. And so if you're going to postulate something, some other part of nature that we haven't yet discovered, which interacts with matter at the energies at which we're now speaking to each other, then it is extremely difficult to do that without damaging precision measurements from all of particle physics, actually, for the last 30 or 40 or 50 years. Not even the LHC is just another example of high precision measurements that we make. So the point is, we understand how matter behaves. We look for a fifth force of nature, for example. It's one of the things that we do. We see no evidence of it. We look for different interactions that matter could undergo, and we see no evidence. So my point really is, to be very precise, if you want to believe in something that interacts with our bodies that we've not detected at the LHC, you have to read all the papers that were published at the LHC, which tried to look for different interactions.
Okay.
And you have to make sure your theory doesn't conflict with those papers. And I'm telling you, it is extremely difficult to do that. So it's in that technical okay. sense that I say,
wow.
So I summarized all that into a soundbite, which is that the LHC shows us that ghosts don't exist. What I really mean is the history of particle physics. But you see the point. You've got to postulate something that interacts with matter, carries information about it, which we don't detect in high-precision experiments.
As a science communicator, what is the concept that you have the most trouble explaining to laymen like me?
The relativity always causes problems. So just in the sense, especially when you look at it in the context of cosmology. So a question that I often get asked is, what happened before the Big Bang? That's a really common question. Or does the universe have an edge? Which is a similar kind of question, actually, ultimately. Is there an origin in time? Is space infinite? Mm-hmm. What is the universe expanding into?
Yeah.
These are questions that we get asked a lot. And they are quite difficult to answer just verbally in a minute or so. I mean, you can answer them. What happened before the Big Bang is, we don't know.
Yeah, right.
We don't even
which
know.
Which is okay to say.
Yeah, we don't even know if there was an origin in time. That's...
Wow.
So it can be that the universe is eternal. Some of our best theories actually now that predict, for example, the way that galaxies are distributed across the universe, those theories require that the universe was in existence before it was hot and dense.
Wow.
So some of them, there's a theory called inflation, which suggests that before the Big Bang, which we now are more precise and called the hot Big Bang. So before the universe was hot and dense and filled with the particles out of which we are made, the universe was still there and it was stretching very fast. And it was in a very real sense cold and empty. There's no structures in it. The matter out of which galaxies are made was not in it. But it was stretching very fast, which is why it's called inflation. And then that period drew to an end. And in the coming to a close of that period, as space and time stop stretching so fast, that's the thing that created the Big Bang, essentially, or heated the universe up. And so that's a theory of something that happened before the Big Bang in the old-fashioned sense. And then you ask the question, well, did that have a beginning? And we really don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. So that's one example. That there are other theories that are explored. Neil Turok, for example, who runs the Perimeter Institute now, the director of Perimeter Institute in Canada, he has a theory which other people think is certainly viable, which is the universe sort of expands and then contracts. It's a bouncing universe.
Yeah.
So you get a cyclical universe, which is eternal. Also, if you just put matter and energy and radiation into the universe, it tends to stretch under quite general conditions or shrink. So essentially what we know from our measurements, what we suspect is that there's a kind of stuff in the universe which at the moment comprises about 70% of the energy in the universe.
Wow.
Which is the kind of stuff that makes the universe stretch faster. And we call it dark energy.
Right.
So it's got a name. We don't know what it is. We don't know the nature of it. Sometimes it's called the cosmological constant. It was in Einstein's theory in 1915. It was in there. It's a kind of stuff that it's possible. And that seems to be what's there.
That's what you're working on at the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, no.
Figure out the nature of dark matter?
There's dark matter. So there's two things we don't know in the universe.
Yeah.
There's dark matter, which is almost certainly a kind of particle, a new kind of particle that interacts very weakly with other matter.
Okay.
It's very well established from many different independent measurements.
Wow.
So we're all as sure as you can be without actually having seen one that these particles exist. Now, I think many of us thought that we would see them at LHC, and we haven't. So we haven't seen new particles other than the Higgs particle. So that's kind of a surprise, I think. But there are other experiments that are trying to detect these dark matter particles directly. Because if they exist, I emphasize we're pretty sure that they do, then they'll be in this room now. They'll be flying around. We're in a sea of dark matter, basically. It outnumbers the matter out of which stars and galaxies are made, that are the things that shine, the gas and dust and stars. It outnumbers that 5 to 1 in the universe. So we see that through its gravitational effects. Mm. So there's that. So that's pretty well established. We almost certain it will be a huge surprise, possible, I suppose, but exciting. A huge surprise if that's not a new particle mm-hmm. floating around. The dark energy, on the other hand, is a much more difficult problem. So it would be beautiful if something at LHC pointed towards gave the theorists a helping hand so they could get a handle on that. But I think it's one of the most challenging problems in theoretical physics. But we can measure. The point is, though, we can measure very directly and precisely how fast the universe is expanding, and also the history of the expansion. Okay. As you think about astronomy, if you look at, let's say you look at the Andromeda galaxy, it's just over 2 million light years away, which is our closest large galaxy. That means that you see it as it was 2 million years in the past, because it's taken the light 2 yeah. million years to travel to us. So when you're looking at galaxies that are 13 billion light years away, or were when they emitted the light, you can see that the expansion of the universe is encoded into that light. Wow. That light's been traveling through an expanding universe for 13 billion years.
That is mind-blowing.
So as you look further out into the universe, you get it's a four-dimensional picture, basically. So you're not only seeing distant things, but you're seeing back in time. And so we can use that to reconstruct the expansion history of the universe with quite high accuracy. So we can see, given Einstein's theory, we can see how the space is responding, and therefore we can deduce what's in it and how that's changed over time. And so we can get quite a precise picture of the evolution of the universe.
Wow.
But it doesn't mean to say we know what that stuff is.
Yeah.
So we know what it does.
Yeah.
But quite a lot of it, we don't know what it is.
I mentioned earlier that you have this big live tour coming up called Universal Adventures in Space and Time. What kind of subjects are you tackling in these live shows?
Well, it's there are different levels. At one sense, it's about cosmology. So it's about, but really, it is also, and I'm quite explicit in the shows, cosmology is a I think, fascinating and terrifying to people in equal measure. So it's fascinating because we're talking about the origin and evolution of the universe. How big is the universe? What's in it? Those questions. But also, it's about our place. You can't escape questions about our place and what it means to be human. Once you're presented with the idea that even the Milky Way galaxy has got somewhere between 200 and 400 billion stars, and that's our current measurements of it, and most of those are planetary systems, 400 billion stars, of which we are one. It takes light 150,000 years to cross it. So it's a big island of stars. But that's one of around 2 trillion galaxies in the part of the universe we can see, which is called the observable universe. And we think the universe extends way beyond that. It may even be infinite. So immediately that challenges our idea of who we are. What does it mean? Does it mean we're insignificant? Well, physically, yes. But at the same time, you can argue that we haven't seen life elsewhere. This is one example. We haven't even seen microbes anywhere. And we've looked, in the neighborhood on Mars and perhaps the moons of Jupiter.
But what about what they found? Didn't they find the building blocks of biology there?
We see the
Mars?
Building blocks.
Yeah.
So we see things like amino acids. Mm-hmm. And that's not surprising, I think, because chemistry is universal. So so I wouldn't be surprised if we found microbes on Mars tomorrow, and we have missions there at the moment looking. And a series of new missions, actually, which are going to go in the near future to really explicitly look for the first time since the Viking missions of the 1970s that NASA did. So I wouldn't be surprised, but that would be microbes. So certainly in the solar system, at best, we'll have microbes. I have a friend who's a professor of zoology at the University of Manchester who likes to say, if you look at the Milky Way sweeping across the sky, he likes to look at it and say, all there will be there is slime. So from a biologist's perspective, the evolution of complex life and certainly intelligence was a tortuous route. It took the best part of 4 billion years on Earth to go from the origin of life, 3.8 billion years ago, let's say, to anything complex. There's no complex living things on Earth at all until about 600 million years ago. So you've got 3 billion years at least, probably more, from the origin of life to get to the point where you have anything with more than one cell, basically. So that may suggest that complex multicellular life is rare. So that's just one example that, what I try to do in the shows is yes, I present the beauty and the challenge of astronomy and cosmology. I also talk about black holes, which are the Einstein's theory of relativity colliding. They're the reason black holes are interesting, I think, really, is because they're the collision of our ignorance with our knowledge, which is what we talked about at the start of the podcast. Yeah. They really are what the cutting edge of our understanding of how the universe works. So whilst we don't know the details, we do have a good understanding of the universe from very early on, all the way through the formation of planets and stars and galaxies. A lot of detail there that we don't fully understand, but we have a broad sweep. So that's I like to say to people, it's for you to go away at the end of these shows this evening and make of it what you will. But what I am trying to draw attention to what we know, and also give my opinion a little bit on how what we know might feed into those discussions that we all have late at night when we're having a drink or something.
Yeah.
We're all students. We all sat there. What's the meaning of it all?
Yeah.
I use a quote, actually, from Richard Feynman at the start of the shows, which he said, you know, what is the meaning of it all? He asked the question in his famous essay, The Value of Science. And he says, actually, ultimately, we have to admit that we don't know. But in admitting that, we find the open door. The open door to knowledge is the idea that we don't know everything, but we do know some things.
Wow.
So we can start to build on them.
I should point out that these really are shows that you're putting on. You have high resolution, big screens, and digital effects from the same people who did the movie Interstellar.
They're great. DNEG, they're called. They're called DNEG, or Double Negative. They're a graphics company in the UK. Well, they're actually all over the place. They're in LA as well. And what they did for Interstellar, because Chris Nolan is so obsessed with accuracy.
Right.
And Kip Thorne was very heavily involved. I know you.
So
what they did was they coded Einstein's theory of general relativity, so the predictions of Einstein's theory, into their graphics software. So when you see a black hole in Interstellar,
you can see the theory illustrated.
It actually solves the equations, and it ray traces light from a distant star background.
Oh, that's amazing.
Through around the black hole. And so what you see in Interstellar when you see the black hole, Gargantua, is the best description of a black hole we can come up with using Einstein's theory.
Wow.
So I got to use that code because they had the code.
How cool.
So they've done, so as I said, black holes are very central to the story of all of physics because they're where our knowledge stops.
Wow.
Right. Oh, no, that's wrong. It's not our knowledge stops. Okay. A lot of physicists who are listening will get upset about it. It's where the known collide with the unknown. Mm. So we know a lot, but we also don't know some stuff. And black holes are the laboratory, one of the laboratories to test that.
That's so cool.
And so they were generated by DNEG. And,
you're bringing some of your old rock star aesthetic to science, huh?
Well, it's because the thing is, that astronomy is spectacular. And humbling. Carl Sagan actually said astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. So part of it is the scale and beauty.
Mm-hmm.
But so for that, we wanted to use these big LED screens. And the great thing about this tour, although I'm not as well-known here in the States, in the UK, I can do very big shows. So
it's you fill arenas.
Yeah, so it's designed for 10, 12, 15,000 seat arenas. So all the very expensive graphics that you can have made, I can play with really expensive toys. Then I can come to the States and bring all that stuff with me. And although we'll be in, 1,500, 2,000 seaters or whatever in the States, it still has that massive investment in graphics. So I'd like to say the audience in the States are getting it cheap.
Yeah.
It's good value here in the States.
Well, before we go, I just have to ask, what is the status of your feud with Deepak Chopra?
Deepak. It's funny, actually, because it started because, obviously we don't see eye to eye on the nature of things. I mean, for example, I think Deepak thinks that consciousness is a pre-existing.
I mean, one could say he doesn't see
thing.
Eye to eye with reality, I guess, in some respects.
But I would say it's a good-natured bit of toing and froing on Twitter. And but actually, you know what, though? Recently, I've realized that, as you said, that there are real problems we have at the moment. Yeah. And so I think I've come to think that people who just believe in nonsense are not necessarily the biggest challenge that we face.
Yeah.
So,
oh man,
so I've kind of mellowed a bit. I'll resume my good natured feud with Deepak when we've solved the rather more pressing problems that we've got in politics.
When you return to California, maybe you should invite him to a show here in L.A.
Well,
he's in the neighborhood, pretty much.
Maybe I should actually say, look, this is my view.
It's your mea culpa.
This is what I think about the
excellent.
Not just me, but all these people from Newton onwards. So Galileo, Newton, Copernicus, Feynman, Einstein. You know, this is what we think now.
Well, once again, the tour is called Universal Adventures in Space and Time. And again, you can find dates and get tickets at profbriancoxlive.com.
Yeah.
There's
also briancoxlive.co.uk if you don't mind.
Okay.
But my promoter who set aside, he's listening now, and he said no, in the States and Canada, we don't like the .co.uk thing, so you have to have a .com.
Well, definitely go check out the tour. It's called Universal Adventures in Space and Time. Professor Brian Cox, thanks so much for talking with me.
Pleasure.
Thanks again to Professor Brian Cox for joining me on the podcast. Don't miss his world tour called Universal Adventures in Space and Time. Find out more and buy tickets at profbriancoxlive.com. Or if you're in the UK, visit briancoxlive.co.uk. Also, be sure to subscribe to Brian's podcast, The Infinite Monkey Cage, and follow him on Twitter at Prof. Brian Cox. Flatiron School is reinventing education, starting with student outcomes. With courses in software engineering, data science, and UX/UI design, Flatiron School stands behind its students with a tuition money-back guarantee. Learn more at flatironschool.com/kickass. That's flatironschool.com/kickass. In today's age, it can be hard to sit down and learn more. You may think you don't have time to read a book. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for my audience. Go to blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. One more time, that's Blinkist.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.